And all of a sudden, I saw a piece of black move from behind a rock. I stopped. I said, that's not a sheep. That's not a goat. And then that piece of black rose, and it was a black turban. He raised his rifle. 12 men came roaring down the mountain, running down the mountain, spread out like an Indian movie. And can I get down, and one had a walkie-talkie, and I said, "That's a sophisticated piece of equipment there. Where's that? Where does that come from?" And he came right up to me, and I'm trying to pass as an Afghan. I could never be seen as an American because what became a big part of my case, which motivated a lot of people, was I was the next American journalist kidnapped in Pakistan after Daniel Pearl.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking hot air.
I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually you could change. The people are the ones that can make the change.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to Change Agents, an Ironclad original. My guest today is Jerry Van Dyke, and he has a very interesting experience, personal experience, and that is of being an American political prisoner abroad. Specifically, I was just about to say Afghanistan, but he was actually likely held in Pakistan. Jerry Van Dyke is a Pulitzer-nominated journalist, and he's also a U.S. Army veteran. And he's an expert on the Middle East and Afghanistan. He was working in the Middle East, embedded with the Mujahideen during the fighting with the Soviet Union. So we're talking back in the late 70s, early 80s. And he returned back to Afghanistan after 9/11 as a CBS News reporter. In 2006, he actually became the only journalist to return to the mountains near the Pakistan border, where Army Ranger Pat Tillman was killed. And in 2008, he was traveling through the tribal areas of Pakistan that border Afghanistan and was captured and then held captive for 45 days. He writes about that in his book, Captive, My Time as a Prisoner of the Taliban. Now has written another book called The Trade, My Journey into the Labyrinth of Political Kidnapping. Since his time in captivity, he has worked with the FBI, the State Department, and the National Security Council to bring American hostages home. He has also worked with the National Counterterrorism Center and the White House to craft U.S. hostage policy.
It all started really in 1973 when I was still in Paris. I'd happened to read a book about Afghanistan. I saw a poster one day in the street of this fascinating looking man with a turban and a beard, and said Afghanistan. And also during that time, this was before the black curtain, if you will, of radical Islam descended upon Asia. I would hear this among students in cafes. And also I had been in part of the time in the army, I was based in Germany. So I had this entree, if you will, this understanding a bit of what students and young guys my age were thinking about, talking about. You could buy a car in primarily Germany, but you could also do it in the Netherlands and drive, even whether it was a Mercedes or a beat up Volkswagen, you could drive it across to Asia, sell it for a profit, and fly home. And there was a book by a fellow named Paul Thoreau, who it's called The Great Railway Bazaar. And he wrote about the train across Asia, but it's also today called The Hippie Trail. And if you ever saw a movie called Midnight Express, it's about a guy named Billy Hayes, who was a drug trafficker who got caught and was put in prison in Istanbul or in Turkey. It's about all that. And so at that time, I in all this all travel, if you will, they say it's escape or pursuit. I want to do this. I wanted an adventure. And so I called my parents in Washington State, asked if my younger brother, who was just finishing high school, could not go to college, but could join me. And to this day, all our parents are gone. To this day, we don't understand why our mother said yes. But and so I bought an old Volkswagen, $300 in Germany. And you have this, what's called it, it was an oval plate, it looked like. And that was an international license plate. And you can get an international driver's license. And so my brother came across, we met in Germany, and we drove a car across Asia. We drove on a road, it's called the, something like the Beltway in the US, if you will, in Washington, D.C., if you will, from Herat, which is very elegant city. It's really, it's a Persian city in Eastern and far Western Afghanistan, on a paved road built by the Soviet Union. You could tell by the way, I mean, it was solid, but you could tell by the way it was engineered, if you will. It was not a slick American highway. And we got to Kandahar, and I remember going, we slept outside at a house where a bunch of Europeans, mostly Europeans, were having a party. And it was that era when you could travel. And then from Kandahar, we followed another highway, which was completely different, which is built by the US. The competition between the US and Russia, Soviet Union, very much was at play for everybody to see in the building of this highway that they divided between the two of them in Afghanistan. And so we got to Kabul in very little money. And so we stayed there. Eventually sold the car in the Khyber Pass for the romance of it all, put my brother on a bus. There were hippie buses, if you will, and came back. But at that time, Kabul, 250,000 people. Today, probably 3 million. In the afternoons, it would be silent because no cars, long camel caravans come through the street, work their way from the south on their way north. The police rode horses, rifles on their back. There were, according to scholars, in particular, a book called Afghanistan by I forget his name at the moment, Louis Dupree. It's published by Princeton University Press a long time ago. 6,000, 5,000 to 6,000 international hippies were living in Afghanistan. It was, and this is not well known, but it's the hippies that introduced or brought Afghanistan into the international drug trafficking markets. They had no idea of this, no concept whatsoever. I recall during in the evening, toward the evening prayer, I could hear the Rolling Stones mixed with the call to prayer. And I put him on what was called a hippie bus that traveled, brought hippies back and forth. And he made his way back. And then I got a cheap plane ticket up to the cheapest flight was on Aeroflot, the Russian Airlines, from Afghanistan, from Kabul to Tashkent. This is when they controlled Central Asia, as you know, to Kabul back to Paris, something like $250, and then came home. I was watching the television, my parents, and I saw the Soviet tanks roll into Kabul, and I said, I have to go back. I have to. I have no choice. It was something I didn't even think twice about. And so what I did, I was still living in Washington, and I called, this is pre-technology time, I called every newspaper I could, Washington Post. The first one who was really responsible, very professional, was Rolling Stone. And so eventually I, after 12 phone call, on the 12th phone call to New York, New York Times said, come up and we'll see you. And I went into, and I met with the foreign editor and the deputy foreign editor. One fellow knew a little bit about my athletic background, which helped enormously. But they said, I remember the foreign editor said to me, I meet a lot of charlatans in this business. How do I know we can trust you? And I made a comment about Camus, the writer, French writer, who had played soccer as a boy in Algeria, said, all I know about ethics, I know from sports. And they said, and I was not then a full-fledged correspondent, I wasn't anything. But the next day, the deputy foreign editor, Craig Whitney, took me into a room and he gave me a check for $500 and a letter. New York Times letterhead said that Jerry Van Dyke has received $500 to do research in South Asia. He said, take this money, go out tonight in New York and have the best night of your life. Apply to a plane ticket to Pakistan. Decide that you don't want to go in. You can do whatever you want. The money is yours. All that counted was that they trusted me. So I went to Pakistan, made my way up to Islamabad. One day, the Times bureau chief took, we had lunch at an old British hill station. He took me up into outside. We looked west toward Afghanistan. All you could see was mountains and trees. And he said, don't worry about the story. It will come to you. And I felt a sigh of relief. I didn't know how nervous I was. And that was my beginning as a foreign correspondent. So what I did, I took the train up, took a shower on the border. You know the area now. And then I went to the seven, found a driver and went to the seven major political religious parties. And I did not know this at the time, that Pakistan allowed to exist, to look for somebody, one group that I trusted to take me in to Afghanistan. I went to about five of them, didn't really feel close to any of them. Of course, everything is translated. Went into one and went into this one. It's all, everything is, you know, adobe or baked mud compounds. Sat on a wood floor. This guy, gray beard, bandolier, pistol on his belt. He's talking to somebody else. And the fellow he was talking to said, how can we help you? In English. And I said, I want to go live with a Mujahideen. And I knew instinctively that these were the men I wanted to go with. The older man wrote his name is Yunus Khalas, Khalas. He wrote a note on a piece of paper half the size of my hand, and he gave it to the other fellow. And I, that next day, they took me to, a man came, took me to the bazaar to get fitted for Afghan clothes, how to tie a turban, sandals. And next, and the day after that, they came with, two men came, got me at this old British motel where I was staying, and in the middle of traffic, two men got out of the car, two other men got in and with me, and we made our way into the tribal zones of Pakistan, which you know well, the size of Connecticut today, or then years later, the headquarters of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The man who gave me that note, whose name is Yunus Khalas, that is the man that Osama bin Laden stayed with after 9/11.
Really?
Yes, before he went up to Tora Bora.
Wow.
It's all documented, yeah. I knew that I was going to live with these men in the mountains. So I went and I lived in two particular sections in the mountains with Jalal ad-Din Haqqani and 18 men, him and then 17 others from his tribe, Zadran tribe. It was a British photojournalist and me. And 5 years later, half of those men were dead. Today, the Haqqani network is, as you know, enormously powerful.
Yeah. How was your experience different? So obviously you spent an immense amount of time with the Mujahideen. How was it when you returned post 9/11?
Yeah, that is the time I began to feel different from and separate from everybody in America, because when I arrived, worked for CBS now, they hired me the day after 9/11. Flew into Bagram, and which was built by the Russians. And I looked up and I saw a ridge line up there. I said, I wonder if the Taliban are up there watching us. I wonder how different they are from the Mujahideen. I have to find the Mujahideen. I have to find Yunus Khalas. I have to find Jalal ad-Din. I have to find these men who were our close allies. I mean, they met with Reagan three times. I mean, I have a friend who met with Reagan three times. was very much a part of the peace talks in with the Taliban, but it was a very close ally in the 1980s. In fact, one thing I didn't tell you, and this also contributes to it, after I came back and then a few years later, Zalmay Khalilzad, who was in charge of the peace talks that led to our leaving Afghanistan, came to me, and we worked in the Reagan administration on a project called Friends of Afghanistan, very closely with Pakistan and the Mujahideen. They were our very close allies against communism, against the Soviet Union. So now I'm back in Afghanistan, and I say, I wonder to what degree are the Taliban different? I know Al-Qaeda has risen. There's this man named Osama bin Laden. And I was determined to find out. And so on my own, I would go out to try to talk to people. And not as, I was doing my work with CBS, but at the same time, I felt, I won't say completely separate, but I didn't have the hatred toward the Taliban that America did, because one, I knew or sensed that the Arabs were, they were outsiders. And Al-Qaeda was separate from they're Arabs, and the Arabs are different from Afghanistan. They're both from Afghans. They're both Muslims, but it's the difference between, say, in southern Germany, someone's Catholic, but so are Mexicans Catholic. But they're completely different ethnic groups. So I was trying to figure out not just to what degree they are different, but how much they are the same. And that became an important part of my time there. But I also knew that, and this became very clear when I, after, if you recall this, in 2002, when the U.S., I think it was you'll be able to correct me, the X, I don't know what it is, the Mountain Division, was in, what really got me was in a place called Shahikot. And it was March 2002 when the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were making their final stand. And we were launched, the U.S., U.S. Army, was launching its large, what they said, Army said, was its largest ground offensive since Vietnam. And I remember standing on a field, a bunch of international journalists, watching a B-52 circling overhead. And I could see the smoke puffs coming up. And I thought, there's a serious battle going on there at Shahikot. That's where I lived with Jalaluddin Akhani and his men. It's in Paktia province near Gardez. And I'm 5-10 miles away, as close as the military would allow us to watch that. And I go, yes, they now we're fighting the men that we were close to, people who saved my life, three times. So now they are our enemy. And I remember from then, I learned that Jalaluddin Akhani had built a big mosque in Khost province, where you may have been, in Khost City. And I wanted to go look at that. And I remember going up, took the trail up, came down, and there was a roadblock, and there was in civilian clothes waved at me. He said, come up here. It was an American. They were three or four special forces guys. He said, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm going down there. Well, be careful. And I said, these are my countrymen. We're in this together. And I'm going to try to go find a man who's today their enemy. I have become their enemy. I'm no longer protected by the Mujahideen. I'm the enemy of the Taliban. And I'm caught in this. So I thought it's a long-winded way of answering your question, but it was not easy.
Yeah, I suspect that it was not. What eventually led to your abduction when you had returned to Afghanistan?
Right. Okay. In 2006, I'll try to do this real quickly. I, like every American, I knew about the death of Pat Tillman, of course. And I was looking at the New York Times, sitting in the CBS newsroom, and reading an interview on the front page. It was in April 2006, with Pat Tillman's father. And he's holding a rock, and he said, and he said something like, see that house 65 yards away? And you're telling me that they couldn't see where my son was, and so forth. And I just said, something is not right about this whole story. It's uncertain. He's killed by friendly fire, but there's something missing. I didn't know what it was. I want to go back and look into this. I was I have an athletic background. I was in the military. I know Afghanistan pretty well. I'm an outsider. I want to go back. I talked to everybody at CBS. Good idea, Jerry, but no, cost too much money. We're not going to, too dangerous. We're not going to allow you to do it. So I, part of my job was to work with 60 Minutes. I piggybacked on a 60 Minutes project over. I went over on my own, and I, using my own money, I hired guards and guides. And for the first time in 25 years, I went back up into the mountains dressed as an Afghan. And then I went to the canyon where Pat Tillman was killed. And I went there twice and talked to Afghans who were there to try and establish what truly happened. And so it was at that same time, and because of my background in the military, I had a tie to the Army War College, and I was on a contract to write a monograph, academic paper on the history, rise, and present state of what we in the West call Islamic fundamentalism. And so I had to do that. And so it was wild. So I had visited, I was up in the mountains again. I wore Afghan clothes. I had this long project in South Asia, Kashmir and India, and Bangladesh and Pakistan, Afghanistan, to write this thing. While doing that, I got a call, what every writer wants, and that was from I got a call from Times Books, Book Division, New York Times. And they said, Jerry, it's clear the CIA does not know where Osama bin Laden is hiding. It's you know the tribal areas of Pakistan. It's like a blank space on the map. Can you go there? And I said, and I honestly said this to myself, yes, I want to do this. It's a book contract. I know, I sense that Jalaluddin had a tie to bin Laden. If I could get to the Akhanis, I could find out something about bin Laden. So I returned, and it was this that led me up into the mountains for 7 months, back and forth, meeting with the Taliban, who always protected me until they didn't. And that led on my fourth trip in breaking the laws, the FBI later informed me, and I realized that, into the tribal areas of Pakistan, researching this book, Bajor Tribal Agency in the north. I was kidnapped by 12 Taliban.
Were they calling it Waziristan at that time?
Waziristan was south. Waziristan okay. Waziristan, good question. Because it's important in my life over there. Waziristan is in the south. Bajor is closer across from Kunar Agency in the far north.
Yep.
Chitral, way up there. Yeah.
I think we colloquially just called that entire tribal region that was neither claimed or owned by Afghanistan, Waziristan. Right or wrong, but that's what we called it.
We called it Waziristan. Okay. Yeah.
Are you looking for a change agent in the energy space? Look no further. Ketone IQ is a category leader. Fuel does not need to be filled with caffeine and sugar. HVMN is changing the narrative. No sugar, no caffeine, no BS. It's just calm, clean energy on demand that improves performance and cognition. HVMN was awarded a $6 million Phase 2 STTR by the U.S. Special Operations Command to produce a ketone-based product that would improve performance at altitude and protect against cognitive loss in hypoxic environments. I'll be honest with you, the flavor is rough, but what's real is the energy, the sustained energy that you will get when you take Ketone IQ. Actually, probably my favorite thing about it though, beyond the energy that you get from it, or in addition to the energy that you get from it, is its size. I mean, you can stuff a couple of these in your backpack. It's not bulky, it's not a full-size drink. Throw it in your bag, take one when you need it, and you're off and running with clean, sustained energy. Please go check out our partner, HVMN, the brand behind Ketone IQ, at hvmn.com/changeagents. I'll hit you with that one more time. Let's do it military phonetically. HotelVictorMikeNovember.com/changeagents. Still got it. It's no big deal. To receive 30% off your first subscription order of Ketone IQ. Hey, everyone. Andy Stumpf here, the host of the Ironclad original Change Agents podcast. In addition to producing podcasts like Change Agents, Danger Close with Jack Carr, Oil and Whiskey with Roadster Shop, and others, Ironclad also works with some of the world's biggest brands like Mechanics Wear, Under Armour, the Navy SEAL Foundation, Anthem, and a ton of others to create industry-leading custom film series, commercials, podcasts, and more. We can also get your message in front of an audience of millions by placing it on podcasts and series just like this one. To check out more about Ironclad and see how they can help you elevate your company, brand, or business, check out thisisironclad.com. Thisisironclad.com. Okay, so you're captured because you're touristing in what we'll call Waziristan, colloquially. What was the motivation of the people that captured you, and then how did they treat you?
The motivation is very, I don't like to use the word, it's overused, complex. It's not like most kidnappings, which are to revenge against, let's say, America, but money, right? Those are the two main ones. Revenge and a form of I consider today political kidnapping, which is certainly a growth industry since 9/11. It's a form of warfare,
almost extortion and, too.
Yeah, well, money, serious money, and
yeah,
other things you can get. And so, what happened? We were single file, walking through the mountains, and it was toward sundown, and I had my one bodyguard, Kalashnikov, in the lead, then another one about 20 yards behind, and then me about 20 yards behind him, and then my fixer 30 yards behind me. And all of a sudden, I saw a piece of black move from behind a rock. I stopped. I said, that's not a sheep. That's not a goat. And then that piece of black rose, and it was a black turban. He raised his rifle. 12 men came roaring down the mountain, running down the mountain, spread out like an Indian movie. And can I get down. And one had a walkie-talkie, and I said, that's a sophisticated piece of equipment there. Where does that come from? And he came right up to me, and I'm trying to pass as an Afghan. I could never be seen as an American, because what became a big part of my case, which motivated a lot of people, was I was the next American journalist kidnapped in Pakistan after Daniel Pearl, who was slaughtered by Al-Qaeda.
Had his head cut off on the internet
4 years before.
Yeah.
So, and as the man said to me, I'll get into that later, but we did everything. And that story, by the way, continues. Kidnapping never ends. I have some fascinating things that's happened even recently on that. So what happened was I tried to, yes, where I was, where would we come from? Where were we going? And I tried to tell him in Pashto, and I said, you're not Pashto. Yeah, obviously I'm not Pashto. But I couldn't dare let him know I was American. They took me up onto a ridge, turned me west, and blindfolded me, and tied my hands behind my back, and cocked a rifle. And at that time, I was like a sheep. I didn't do anything. I was just in shock, petrified, and waited. And I thought of my family, and looked west, and I couldn't see anything, but I knew I was facing west, facing toward America. And I waited for that to happen, for them to shoot me. But then they pulled me up and took me down a mountain, or down into a gravel area, threw me in the back of a car. And for the next 2 hours or so, I have no concept of time, we either drove in circles or drove in on gravel, dirt. And then eventually they pulled me out again. And then on the ground, And then, and you watch the smallest things. And this is trying to answer your question real quickly. You watch for the smallest things. How are they treating me? Is there any sense of humanity here, or am I simply a dead man very soon? And so they took me out of the car, and then they put me back in the car, and it was dark. Then I could just feel it was nighttime. And I realized I was the only one in the car. In the back. And then they went up the mountain, and I said, oh, they're going to drive me up to the top of this dirt road, and they're going to behead me. And so they brought me into a baked mud cell, and I was happy because I saw my bodyguards there. I didn't realize that they had betrayed me then. That came later. And I saw the spike. There were four cots, rope cots, in that room, and they sat me down on one, and I looked at the spike in the floor next to me with the chains, and I looked on for blood on the wall, and I said, I'm in a Taliban prison in the mountains, and no one could find me. I believe to cut through everything that what they intended initially was ultimately, obviously I was freed, but there were other people behind them. In fact, one to cut through a whole host of things, and this is not the only thing that's happened recently, but when we were there that night, and my bodyguards were talking to the Taliban leader and the others in the room, all with rifles, all frightening me, said, my men said, we have permission from Abdul Wali. I didn't know that name at all. And I remembered that name because that name would come up. And you can tell me when, I forget now, is it a year? The US launched a drone attack in Kabul and killed Ayman al-Zawahiri. Mm-hmm. So when was that, a year ago, give or take?
It was within 18 months, I believe.
Okay, so let's just say 18 months ago. What was not reported, because it wasn't, no one knew, but I read this. I happened to first read it. I don't know why. I was just on the computer, and I saw something in NBC News that a drone hit a car in which Abdul Wali was riding. And I found out that that car was steel plated. I called a lot of people, found out that car was steel plated. But that he drove around in a steel plated car. The US, how many years is it now? From 2008 to 2023.
15.
Got my man. Just so, in other words, the enormous gratitude I feel toward America, that they did not forget me. They did not, two things I did not forget, but that Abdul Wali is a very important man based in Pakistan, who is the ultimate person behind me. So my case was very much something much larger than simply because of my background. I was targeted for different reasons. And another part of it that explains Abdul Wali, one day, my main jailer, just let slip that, or on purpose told me that the political agent had come to see him. Now, I've never had anybody in the US government ever mention anything, because I do a lot of work in that world no one in the US government has ever said anything to me remotely using the word political agent. I was in a pub in 2010 in England with two British policemen. I was trying to write something about looking into this Afghan boys being trafficked across Asia and into Europe for a story I wanted to write, but I wasn't getting anywhere. And the two policemen said, no, we're not gonna help you. We'll give you our phone numbers. But what did the political agent say? They just write out and ask me, what about the political agent? The political agent is someone with an unmarked budget created by the British in the 19th century who today reports directly to the Prime Minister of Pakistan. He is in charge and is expected to know everything, and I've been told he knows everything that happens in his tribal area. So why in the world was the, why would my main jailer say that the political agent had come to see him? Was he telling me the truth? Was he trying to give me some hope? How would he think that I would even know that what the political agent was? I didn't have that. That didn't mean anything to me when he told me that. But I also know when we finally got out and we were walking, I was falling down because I was tired, but kept going. And where our group came, and then in the distance, I saw these things like small cigarette lighters, all little lights. And then these men came up in the fog. And one embraced me, and he had a lot of weaponry, and he had called a pateau, the garment, the piece of the cloth that they wear as a shawl, if you will, and even to sleep on, used to cover themselves when they sleep. Boy, he had a lot of weaponry. It's not just a single Kalashnikov. Plus, we came to a place, and I was put me down on a cot, and they said, "You want to join us for dinner?" And I watched about 30 men. There were because there were only three Talibs, took me out to this meeting place, and about 30 men walking single file down into a very nice building. This is not something the Taliban would do. They don't live like this. So what I'm saying is, it's more than a doubt.
What were the conditions of your release?
I don't know. But what I do know, no one will ever tell me. What I do know, what they told me initially, it was $1.5 million and three men from Guantanamo.
Okay. So they use you likely as a chess piece on the board and swapped one for another.
I don't know who. There's so much I've tried to find out.
Yeah. How long were you in captivity for?
6.5 weeks. Because of that, and I was the, because of the, and that was when, because of Daniel Pearl, they were going all out. And I've heard many stories of from military to espionage to all kinds of things that this country was doing to try and prevent that from happening again.
How big of a problem are political kidnappings?
It's on the rise. It's getting worse. And the reason it's becoming worse is because it's now state sanctioned. I don't believe when I would hear, I remember President Obama, they invited all of us to the White House to in 2015, all of those who survived and the families of those who didn't present this new American approach to kidnappings, that they would allow in certain instances different ways. Still, we would not pay, but just that we're going to change our policy. And I remember President Obama said, these groups, whether it's Al-Qaeda or Al-Shabaab or Boko Haram, pick any jihadist group that you want, they operate in areas where there's no government. And I beg to differ, because I don't believe in my research, in this last book and all my work, that jihadist groups operate in a vacuum. I don't believe that they are on their own. They get some financing from say, just a wealthy prince in Saudi Arabia, and they form their own jihadist group. No, I feel that they are backed by forces far greater who use them for their own needs.
What is the current U.S. policy when it comes to American citizens or political prisoners?
It's largely unchanged. We do not officially pay a ransom. I can think of three cases. One that you may know personally about, is a, when was this? 2015, I met and listened and we talked. A group of us talked in Washington. I just listened to him. Lieutenant Colonel Jason Amerine. And Jason Amerine was with President Karzai at the very beginning and distinguished himself and was rising through the ranks, Lieutenant Colonel, and gone to West Point. And he was tasked by the Pentagon or by his whomever to think, this is his words, think outside the box to find a way to try and find out where Bo Bergdahl is and to bring him home. Find out. That was part of his job. And what he had done, where he made his unfortunate, if you will, mistake, I'm certainly not going to judge anything he did. He was on television and it testified before a congressional committee in which he said he had paid ransom for proof of life videos. And that, I think it was twice. I forget exactly the whole circumstances, but you can see it all online. Mm-hmm. And so he was forced to leave. And in 2000, before 9/11, there were two American missionaries who were kidnapped, Jason and forget his wife's name. Not Jason. There were two an American missionary couple kidnapped in the Philippines by Abu Sayyaf, jihadist group, South Philippines. Yep. And the Bush administration paid a ransom. And the statement was, I think, 200,000, let's say. It didn't, unfortunately, he was killed in a shootout, the husband was. But the point is, if it led to the release of the hostages and the apprehension, if you will, of the hostages, so of the kidnappers. So there's been wiggle room, if you will, in this. But the defining difference between us and other nations, and the British are with us on this, we do not officially pay ransom, and this is what is. It's a very controversial thing, of course. But the U.S. position is largely unchanged. But the trouble now is, and where America's having problems, you're not dealing with Al-Qaeda, you're not dealing with Boko Haram or Al-Shabaab or any other jihadist group, you're dealing with Iran. You're dealing with a nation state, you're dealing with Russia. So it is these nation states have seen how effective it is. Yeah, this policy is of kidnapping and the pressure it puts on a country much larger, Venezuela, that they use this as a form of warfare. And so it is on the rise.
Do you have any sense of how many Americans are currently political prisoners right now?
I do not, but I do know.
What would you estimate it at? Like if you just were to ballpark it?
25, maybe 30. Also, when we're talking about kidnapping, they're also what you have to take into consideration are those who are missing. Someone who's, take one example would be Robert Levinson, the FBI agent who disappeared in 2007 on a duty-free island owned by the Iranians. He was on a contract with the CIA, and toward the end of President Trump's time in office, all the various intelligence agencies met in the White House and told the family that we deduce from all our research and all our knowledge and connections that he's dead. And President Trump said, truthfully, well, there's no body. So missing Americans, yes, they're out there. And they're also very much so. But kidnapping, probably 25. I'm positive there at least one in Afghanistan, positive.
So if we're dealing more with nation states at this point as opposed to smaller organizations, I agree with you. I don't think that terrorist organizations operate inside of a vacuum. I think they are provided much more support than would be publicly facing because it's a mechanism for a nation state to maneuver outside of what would be associated with them directly. But when we're talking about nation state, Iran, Russia, what's the motive behind that? Are they just looking to trade individuals that we as the United States may have in custody? Or what are they looking to do?
No, in my view, it's not to trade. I think Russia uses it to trade, absolutely. Iran is different. It's a matter of humiliation. It's a form of warfare. And it's also something very helpful politically. There's something about kidnapping cases. President Trump made it clear, and it was very, very effectively as a political leader, to always be present when a kidnapped victim was released. Mm-hmm. And in my experience around this world now, dealing with people in and out of government, I have found that they take satisfaction in enormous satisfaction, like this woman holding up my book at who works for the NSA, in releasing an American, bringing an American home. It is so different from dealing with policy and a paper and bureaucratic warfare and all of these other necessities in government, that you're dealing with a human being, you're dealing with a family. And every family in America is aware that, well, that could be my son who's in the military, or my daughter who's in the military, or my nephew who is, a minister, whatever it is. So it's very emotional. And so it's much more effective for smaller states like Venezuela. Iran is using it clearly in the negotiations with the U.S. over whether we're going to allow them to create some kind of non-nuclear energy system. All those negotiations that are going on, about which you and I know very little, only what mm-hmm. we read in the newspaper. The fact is, Iranians are holding people, and that plays a very important part of everything. And it's with little cost, you can create a great deal of trouble.
Is there anything that listeners or viewers of this episode are actually even able to do?
No.
Is that at a government level, essentially, or above?
I don't want to say no glibly so quickly. There's a part of be very careful. When you travel, you're not going to, you cannot be glib about traveling or taking chances. The after effects are so enormous. One very small example is that when I came back in my apartment, there were 16 FBI agents that had gone through my apartment. They had to find out any information they could about me. And as a result, everybody in my apartment building felt that, oh, Van Dyke, the FBI is here. What's wrong with him? And that he is causing our apartment values to go down. I couldn't use the elevator for months. I would walk down the steps, that I was seeing all the trouble I had caused. That's very minor. But when you get kidnapped, you're causing the government enormous problems, because you can tell the listeners, I can't, how much it would cost for the Delta Force or the SEALs or any other group to try and rescue that person. The pressure that comes because that person is somebody that everybody knows and he's in the newspaper. So the thing is, do not be glib about where you're going, number one. Number two, pressure on the government from kidnapping families has enormous effect, because it is something that resonates with, in a way that other policies don't. They're all in the abstract. Whether we open trade with China and XYZ, but this is a prominent Christian missionary that was held in somewhere in Turkey, and President Trump made a point of inviting him into the Oval Office. Good politics, and it helps you in so many other ways. So it has become such a political issue that it's hard to know what the average citizen can do beyond just being very savvy, and to know that if an American is kidnapped, the president of the United States knows it, and he talks about it with the vice president, and the highest levels of government know about it. I've been told that right to my face by different officials in the government. The government knows every day about your kidnapping. So it's on, there's this, I don't know what it's like in Russia or what it's like in any other country, but American officials in Washington at the highest level know about a kidnapping. They care about it. And beyond trying to seek publicity, what is really an awkward thing, really awkward, is money. Because families will try and raise the 1.5 million or whatever it is. And that became a huge problem with those who were executed on television, for the families of those executed on television by ISIS. And so the money factor is a hugely awkward thing. And you cannot tell a family not to do anything under the sun to try and bring their son or daughter home. So they're going to want to negotiate. They're going to want to put up money. And so you're going against your government. The way to do that is to do it very quietly. And yeah, you're going to find people who are going to help you. Jason Amery was doing all his good things he was doing, but unfortunately, somehow that became public. And there was a certain amount of, and this is unfortunate, but you know this, we all know this, and in any group, there's competition. So you have the CIA here, the FBI there. Yeah, when I was in the Army, I remember hearing about a general who once said regarding Vietnam, Viet Cong are not the enemy, Navy's the enemy. You know, it's kind of joking, but it's for funds, for power, for all of these things. And so you get caught up in all of this internecine competition. And so the important thing is to try and to work with everybody, to be completely open and to figure out a way. And you can, I won't say you can do it, but I think the chances of bringing somebody home today are better than before. The trouble is there are many more out there today being held hostage than before.
Mr. Van Dyke, I want to be respectful of your time. What would you like to close out with and leave the listener or viewer with? Closing thoughts by Jerry Van Dyke.
I will get emotional. Gratitude is one of the most wonderful things in the world. And when I was once told by a man, and it's true, that a kidnapping never ends. I knew everything that happened on the inside. I knew nothing about what happened on the outside. But he also said that the ripple effects, you have no idea what the ripple effects of kidnapping will be. And they are enormous. They continue today. And for good and bad. And that I am exceedingly grateful that I live in America, I'm American, and that the government did all it could, and friends did all they could to rescue me. And I feel I have an obligation and a responsibility to do all I can to help those who are out there today because of contacts I have going back, as we've talked, in the 1970s. It spreads from not just in Afghanistan out there, and that's a lot of the type of work I do today. I'm grateful for you, your interest, for giving me this chance to come and talk about this.
Well, I appreciate your willingness and openness to discuss, which can only be described what I would assume is a difficult situation in your life that you were able to work your way through. So I appreciate it.
Thanks, Andy.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your time. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you want to learn more about how you can help Americans being wrongfully detained around the world, you can visit jamesfoleyfoundation.org. That foundation is named for the journalist and war correspondent abducted and beheaded by ISIS in 2014 while reporting in Syria. The organization works to fight for the freedom of the wrongfully detained. Thanks again for listening to Change Agents, an Ironclad original. We'll be back next week with an all-new episode. Until then.